I think we're just about to commence the class today. We'll start in a few minutes. And we ask that once you hear the audio feed, just to type in audio okay at the bottom of the screen. This will give us a confirmation that you're picking up the audio stream properly. And again, we'll just start in a few moments. And we're taking up the area that we discussed last week. We're just going to recap. That's Isaiah chapter 2, and the topic is God's rebuke. And we will start just in about 1 or 2 minutes. And again, once you hear the audio feed, just type in audio okay at the bottom of your screen. Just to give us feedback that you're picking up the audio fine. And if you do miss any part of the class, you will be able to hear it in its entirety by going to the audio link on our website, where we archive all of the classes. And throughout the session, there will be pauses where we'll stop and ask a question and offer you time for, offer you opportunity to type into the bottom of your screen. Afternoon.
Good afternoon, Rabbi. It's Doug Taylor.
Doug, how are you?
Excellent. How about yourself?
Doing well.
Was it a wedding that you went to this morning?
Yes, I forgot all about mentioning it last week. It was 12 o'clock in Brooklyn, so but I got back with plenty of time to look over the material. So,
fantastic. I trust it was a wonderful wedding.
They all are. I don't know of any wedding which is not a wonderful wedding.
Yeah, sure.
How was your week?
It's been good. I was in Washington, D.C. and Chicago this last week, so
you're on the East Coast?
On Friday night.
Oh, you're on the East Coast. You didn't stop by and say hi.
No, I didn't get up your way. Would have loved to have.
He'll have to tack on a little more time, some trip that he's back there.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
What's the train time from D.C. to New York?
I've never done it.
Oh.
I've never done it by train. By car, 4+ hours.
Okay.
I thought I heard it was 3.5 to 4 hours.
Yeah.
It depends who the driver is, I guess. A heavy foot, you'll get there before you leave.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to recap what we did last week. Okay. Let's see, so we're in Isaiah. It's chapter 2. And, okay, so why don't we start? And, wait a second. Actually, so some more insights, so that's good, actually, that we're redoing it. Okay, so Doug, why don't you take it one? Why don't we read it one more time, since you are a designated driver here.
Chapter 2?
Yeah, chapter 2. Just do the whole thing, all 22 verses.
Okay. The prophecy that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. It will happen in the end of days. The mountain of the temple of Hashem will be firmly established as the head of the mountains, and it will be exalted above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. Many peoples will go and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of Hashem, to the temple of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths." For from Zion will the Torah come forth, and the word of Hashem from Jerusalem. He will judge among the nations, and will settle the arguments of many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift sword against nation, and they will no longer study warfare. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk by the light of Hashem. For you have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because they were filled with sorceries of the east and divinations, like the Philistines, and they content themselves with the children of foreigners. Its land became full of silver and gold, with no end to its treasures. its land became full of horses with no end to its chariots. Then its land became full of false gods. Each one of them bows to his own handiwork, to what his fingers have made. Humankind will have bowed and man will have humbled himself, yet you will not forgive them. Enter the rock and be hidden in the ground because of the fear of Hashem and from the glory of his greatness. Humankind's haughty eyes will be brought low, and men's arrogance will be humbled, and Hashem alone will be exalted on that day. For Hashem, Master of Legions, has a day for retribution against every proud and arrogant person, and against every exalted person, and he will be brought low. And against all the lofty and exalted cedars of Lebanon, and against all the oaks of the Bashan, and against all the lofty mountains, and against all the exalted hills, and against every tall tower, and against every fortified wall, and against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the splendid palaces. Humankind's haughtiness will be humbled, and men's arrogance will be brought down, and Hashem alone will be exalted on that day. And the false gods will perish completely, and idolaters will enter caves in the rocks and tunnels in the ground because of the fear of Hashem and from the glory of his greatness when he arises to break the land. On that day, man will throw away his false gods of silver and his false gods of gold, which they made for him to prostrate himself, to moles and to bats, to enter clefts of the rocks and the cracks of the crags, because of the fear of Hashem and from the glory of his greatness when he arises to break the land. Withdraw from man who has breath in his nostrils, for with what is he deemed worthy?
Okay. So it's quite a mouthful. But now let's take it and understand what the message is. So we see that... by the way, Doug, how does it sound over there?
That's much better with the change you just made.
Okay. So, right here is good? All right. Okay, so, what we have at first is the prophecy it says that Isaiah saw, and it was regarding the end of days, meaning the Messianic era. And what is going to happen in that Messianic era, what will happen then, is that euphemistically, that the house of God, which is on the mountain, on Mount Moriah, meaning Jerusalem, will be established, and it will be, in contrast to other places, it says... Nachon yeh har beis Hashem barosh har. It'll be lifted up amongst the valleys, amongst other mountains. I mean barosh har. So it will have higher significance than other places. Okay, and then the people, meaning many nations. See, first it says in verse 2, at the end, it says they will stream to that mountain, Kol Hagayim, all of the nations. Then it says in 3, they will go there, the people, many peoples. So you see it switches off from all the nations to many peoples. It doesn't continue with all, for some reason. But the people will nonetheless, they will say, they will say, let us go and go up. We will ascend to God's mountain, to the house of the God of Jacob. And your question last week, Doug, why is it called the house of Jacob? So I looked in Rashi and he answers. He actually asked your question and he answers it. And he says, because the reasoning is that Jacob called this house the house of Beis Kael, the house of God. So because he was the one, because Jacob was the one that called it that, so therefore they're referring to the God of the Jews as the God of Jacob because of the reference of the place. So since the nations will say, let us go up to the house of God, so they're borrowing the phrase that Jacob spoke about. So therefore, the Jews are referred to as how the nations are calling them. Okay? Right. So the nations say, we'll go to the house of God, And this again will happen in the Messianic era, that the nations will recognize they'll recognize Judaism as being the only divinely given religion. And we mentioned last week that this will only happen if the Jews will not have any type of fear or concern about acting properly, acting in accord with the Torah, not in accord with what their peers want to do. We speak a lot about how this is, and right here, I mean, we don't have to leave this chapter. Isaiah says itself that there's a rebuke of the Jews in verse 7, where it says that your land is full of silver and gold. But it goes on, and that's just the monetary. But it says to no end. So the Jews were completely involved in wealth. And then it says in the end of 7, it says that the land is full of horses and chariots, which of course are used in terms of war. And then it says in 8 that your land is full of idols, the works of your hands. You bow down to that which your fingers made. So we see that that is something, even though it's done by the Jew, you think that the Jew would be acting properly. Evidently, no. Many, many times throughout history, the Jews veered off. Even at Mount Sinai itself, when they're actually receiving the law, they veered off the path. And that's exactly what God said to Moses. He says, go down from me from this mountain, because the people have veered off the path. They have veered off the path that I've commanded them. So here as well. So if the Jews are veering off the path and they're not embodying the right concepts, and it's important to note, and I was just looking before just to get the source, in Devarim, Deuteronomy 4:6 is where it says that the other nations will look at the Jews and they'll say, Rak am chacham v'novan ha'goya gadol zeh. What a great and wise and understanding nation are these Jews. Now, how could the nation say that about the Jews if the Jews are still going after these idolatrous types of practices? And we spoke this week about how there are practices in Orthodox Jewish communities where they invite husbands of women that are pregnant, in like their 9th month or whatever, to open up the ark to bring out the Torah, because the Torah is housed in an ark in every temple, and you have to open it up to take the Torah out for the reading of the Torah every Saturday. So they give this honor to a man whose wife is pregnant, so this way when you open up the doors, it will make the opening up of the womb to have the child easier, which is a completely idolatrous type of a concept. It's not part of Judaism, and Judaism is all based on what makes sense naturally. God gave us intelligence, he gave us understanding, so this way that we can perceive how the laws that he created operate. So he gave us wisdom so we can examine the world. And if you look in Maimonides' book, where he talks about how does a person come to the love of God, so he says right there, he just says, doesn't mention anything about Torah study, he says purely by studying God's world, the universe, natural law, physics, the cosmos, astronomy. So if that's how a person gets close to God, then that's exactly what Abraham did. Abraham had no Torah. So the Talmud says openly he had no Torah. And we know it wasn't given until the year 2448. So the way he was able to perfect himself is by using his intelligence to see how the world operates, to study God's laws. So that is when we do study the laws and we become knowledgeable of them and we live properly. And then when God gave us the Torah, of course, and then we uphold purely all the mitzvos, which are sensible. So then the other nations will look at us and they will say, wow, that law makes sense. That the idea of resting on the seventh day in order that we stand out from the other nations now makes sense, because this now sets us apart and we become noticed by everybody else in order that they ask us, why are you not working when everybody else is? And Maimonides just explains that that's one of the reasons of the Sabbath, is that we will be noticed by other people, that we are deviating and we are not working on that seventh day like everybody else does. They'll ask us why, and we'll have an opportunity to respond to them and educate them on creation and God. So when other nations hear that, That makes sense. It's logical. It follows sensible ideas. But if we invite people up to open up the ark and we think that that has some effect on a woman's biology or red strings on the wrist or any other type of practice which are very predominant today. So this is not something which the nations will be able to look to us, as Isaiah says over here, and that it will invite the other nations to be impressed, like it says in Deuteronomy, we just quoted, that the other nations will only be impressed when we're following things which make sense, which make they're clear. And again, God's system is all pleasant. It all is pleasant to the mind. It's only man's deviations. And you see, this is exactly what is going on in the verses where it says that we copied the Plishtim in verse 4. The people have, God forsook the people. In verse 6 it says over here, the house of Jacob, because they are full of the like warlock practices, the onanim of the Philistines, the idolatrous practices, and with the youth of the nations, they have held on to their philosophies. And then it goes on again. Like we said, and they start, and the Jews were actually corrupt and committed idolatry. So this is what has to be abandoned if there's going to be this messianic era. It's also interesting that we found that one of the practices today that a lot of Jews are involved in is they do this thing called, I don't know, Doug, have you heard about this, where people check the mezuzah? They feel that if somebody's sick in the house, they check a mezuzah?
I have not heard that.
Right, that's something which is a big practice. And there are statements which on the surface sound like that should be done. That, for example, somebody had sent in a quote from a Talmud, and the Talmud says that when Uncleus, the proselyte, was being arrested by the emperor, so the emperor's servants came to arrest him. So as he was leaving his house, he put his hand on the mezuzah of his house, and the emperor's servants said to him, "What is that?" So Uncleus responded, and he says, "Well, our God, our religion is not like yours. Our religion, I'm just paraphrasing, but other kings, they sit inside the house while the servants are outside guarding it. But with us, God is the opposite. We're on the inside of the house, and God is on the outside of the house, meaning the mezuzah, and he protects us." Now, Uncleus, of course, was a very wise individual. He was not saying, he's not saying that God is outside or inside, because God is not physical. So there cannot be any location to God. So we see right off the bat that Uncleus is talking in a metaphoric sense. There's an idea behind his words. But there's also a reason why he responded a certain way. He was just about to get arrested, right? Now, that's not something he would like to happen. If he can avoid that somehow, you avoid it. I mean, that's what Jacob did when his brother was coming to kill him. He planned three things. He planned a political gift. He planned for military evacuation or war. And he also prayed to God. So he covered all bases not to be assaulted by his twin brother, Esav. So Uncleus also, is my understanding of what he said over here, he was also trying to get out of this, this travail that he was now just placed into. So what did he do? He sees that the servants of the emperor are coming, and he understands very, very well that the servants are the ones that have to administer the justice. I mean, if you think about who's the most the person who's in harm's way the most in the United States, who would it be? Who are the people that are in harm's way the most in the United States?
Police officers,
exactly, because they're the ones that are going after the bad guys. We're not going after the bad guys. We're in our homes. We're in our offices. We're in our schools. So we're not really exposed to that threat. Now, Uncleus knows that when these servants of the emperor came, he knows what the psychology is. So what does he do? He plays on their fear. And he tells them, you guys have to be outside protecting your king who's inside. So you're the ones that are in harm's way. But our religion is just the opposite. We are safe inside the house, and God takes care of us. So they liked that so much, the Talmud says that they converted and joined Uncleus in becoming Jews. So Uncleus was very successful in appealing to the very emotion that they had. And in a very simple action of just putting his hand on the mezuzah. I mean, there's no law that you have to put your hand on the mezuzah. But he was trying to catch their attention because he wanted to engage them in a conversation that he hoped would free him from being arrested. And it worked. But when he said that God's on the outside and man's on the inside, it's true that man is inside, but God is not outside. God is not in any place. Something can only be in a location if it's physical. Like, for example, the concept of gravity is not anywhere. The effects of gravity we see, but the concept, the concept itself of gravity, a concept is not something which takes up space, so it can't have any geographical location. So when Unkel is saying that God is on the outside, already you see he's talking metaphoric. So we don't say from this passage, this section in the Talmud, that Unkel is saying in any way that the mezuzah is now protecting your house. It's the merit. And the rabbis themselves say this. Maimonides and Gilead Marsha, they're, you know, very great authorities that we have to rely on that say clearly that if a person thinks that the mezuzah has a protective quality, it physically protects you. So one rabbi says it'll be knives in your eyes, meaning knives in your eyes means that as you look at it, you go inside your house and outside your house, and you look at it each time. It won't be a helpful thing. It'll be like knives sticking in your eyes. It'll be something which is harming you because it's reinforcing a wrong idea. I mean, the mezuzah itself, if you ignite it, it'll burn. So if it can't protect itself, how's it going to protect anything outside of itself? So there's many clear arguments that clearly unveil the belief of mezuzah or any object being protective. It unveils the fallacy of such ideas. So these are just a few of the many that, you know, people are looking. It shows you that people are looking for security, and you know, there's many different ways that a person will seek that out. Ultimately, a person should really rise above all of his infantile needs and recognize that there's only one source for security, and that's God, and that's a level for a person to reach. But this is something which, if we keep on upholding these type of practices where we believe that physical objects have protection, and we take all these stories in the Talmud as literal when we're not supposed to, so then we are corrupting ourselves, and we're hiding the truth from other people, which God's will is that we're not supposed to. We're supposed to set an example. We're supposed to really be setting an example. So this way the entire world will be able to see the truth in unison. So it's a very, very important lesson. Okay, let me just pause right here and see if there's any comments or questions. If you have any, if you're online, you can just type it in the bottom of your screen. And Doug, Cal, if there's any questions you got there.
Rabbi, it seems like the purpose then of the mezuzah is almost twofold. One of them is kind of a reminder for the Jews themselves to observe the Torah, but the other one is an opportunity to teach. But it seems to me that unless you know the mindset of the people that you would be discussing this with, it would be very easy for them to assume that there's some sort of superstitious attachment to it.
In what way would they assume that? What do you mean?
Just by having a physical symbol, in a sense. That some, you know, like the red thread kind of thing, just having a mezuzah up there would be like your house is therefore protected by God.
Well, we don't, we put the tefillin on our body and we put tzitzis on our clothing, but it's all because they're, I mean, I could explain to you, you know, the reasoning. I'll just take quickly, somebody just asking a question online about the hamsa. You know, there's this thing called like a hand. People put a hand around their neck. It's the same thing. They feel that there's protective devices, and when they see so many Jews doing it, so they feel that now it must be part of Judaism, but that's not true. I mean, there's plenty of Jews that are conservative, reform, so we don't say because there's so many Jews doing that and practicing Judaism that way that makes it part of Judaism. But the concept about having a physical item on your house should not be viewed as any different than any other command that we have. I mean, many, many of our commands require that we have certain physical objects, but the objects themselves are there to teach a concept. And Rashi says that if a person does a command He performs a command, but he has no idea why he's doing it, then it's worthless. It really has missed the mark. So let's take, for example, what you're asking, Cal. You're asking about, it seemed to be that on the surface you have a physical object that's on your house, so it looks like it's doing some sort of a protection. Well, the truth is it doesn't look like that. I mean, really, you see a scroll, and it's on the doorpost of the house. And it's also taking a very small part of the house. We also see that Maimonides groups together. Like, if we want to start to understand the concept of mezuzah, we look at how the rabbis organized their laws. And Maimonides groups together the laws of mezuzah, the laws of the tefillin, the black boxes that we wear on our head and arm, and the laws of tzitzis. So why does he group these three together? And also a very amazing thing is that the punishment of leprosy, tzaras, so that's given to a person when they speak lashon hara, they slander somebody else behind their back, or even in front of them. So, and it says by this punishment of leprosy that the leprosy will first go to the house. If the person doesn't heed that warning, then God moves the leprosy into the person's clothing. And if the person still keeps talking his idle speech, his slanderous tongue, and he doesn't take that warning, so then God will ultimately move the leprosy onto his body. Now you notice that the same three areas is where the tefillin, the tzitzis, and the mezuzah are. The mezuzah is on the house, which is where the tzaras first hits you, the leprosy first hits a person. The tzitzis are on the clothing, which is the second degree of where leprosy travels, and the tefillin are on the body, which is the ultimate destination if the person did not listen to the warning. So what's common about all three? Let me stop and let you think about this. What is common between the person's house, the person's clothing, and the person's body that we see that leprosy is given in those three areas? And that Maimonides groups together the laws of mezuzah and tefillin and tzitzis. So you think about it for a second and think, what's the common bond between these three areas? The house, the clothing, and the body. And again, if you have an idea, just type it in on screen. Go ahead, Doug.
Garments, and I'm going to use that in a very broad sense, that are the house for one's soul. I mean, first there's the body, and then on the body you put clothing, and then around the clothing you put a house.
I mean, you don't have to live in a house. You can be a traveler. There's no command to have a house.
No, that's true.
You only have a command on mezuzah if you live in a house. But if you live in a tent, something temporary like a sukkah, we don't put a mezuzah on our sukkah because it's a temporal structure.
Rabbi, can I ask a clarification question?
Sure.
What does tzaras look like on a house or clothing?
I would assume it's the same. It's some sort of a marking of a whitish marking.
Okay.
And there'd be ways to verify that it was actually leprosy. Question is, what do these three locations have in common? It's very interesting. But we see that there is consistency in the Torah. And then we'll also have to see what the relationship is between leprosy and these three mitzvahs, these three commands, that they both apply to the same three locations. There has to be some common bond between these two, which are on the surface.
Would it be that they're a form of protection?
Well, that's what we're saying. If you're going to say it's protection, how is it protection?
Well, the body protects us from, invasion, bacteria, and diseases.
Oh, you mean the body. The locations are a form of protection. Okay, go ahead. Good.
Right. I don't know where I'm going with it, though.
Well, clothing protects you from the elements.
Good.
And housing protects you further from the elements.
Good. Right, I agree with you. I would say even with the protection, it's these three areas are dealing with human security. And in terms of a person's security, see, this is what the Torah is trying to break down, what I was getting on before, that the very mezuzah that people take to believe that it is a protective item, the mezuzah itself, if you look at what is written on it, says that if you relate to objects in a physical way, meaning if you become idolatrous, then you're kicked out of the land of Israel. Which means it doesn't matter if you have a mezuzah on your house. God does not say that if you're an idolater, but you've got a mezuzah on your house, then I'm not going to oust you from Israel. God does not say that. In the mezuzah itself, it says that if you turn aside and you worship idols, which means that you give into this concept that there are physical objects that have a causative nature, and they can provide goodness for you in life, when really they are just physical objects, and they have no powers themselves. They can't protect themselves from a flame. How are they going to protect you? So if a person does stoop to idolatry, the mezuzah itself says on the inside of it that God will exile the Jews from the land. So that's it's an ironic thing that the very item that people are taking to be protective is really the source of the lesson that physical objects have no power. So That itself is something to digest, but it's right there. If they would look at the mezuzah, then they would stop relating to it in a protective way. Now, what happens is that there are three areas that a person puts their security in life. They put it into their homes. That's why people invest so much into beautifying their home. This is my place. The clothing gives a person a sense of pride, his dignity. As they say, the suit makes the man, which means that it is an expression of a person's own status or his ego. And the body, of course, you see how people work out and they take tremendous strains in order to sculpt their bodies muscularly. This is not everybody, but you know, you don't need to have everybody doing something to learn a lesson. So you see three areas that a person puts their security in, and this is exactly what God is attempting to do, is to correct us from putting in investing security into that which really doesn't give you security. So in truth, it's God that's giving us the security. So when you go into your house, you're commanded to put a mezuzah on in order to break down your security that you invest in your house. Remember, it's God really that gives you security. When you put on your clothing, you look at the tzitzis, and again, you are reminded of God, of all of his commandments. And the way we're really supposed to wear tefillin is all day long. But now we just place it on in the morning. But that itself is now on the body in order to break down the body from thinking that this is really where you get your security from. I mean, there's many other ideas as well, and that is not necessarily the most primary concept of tefillin. But the concept is there, and that's why Maimonides groups all three together. Because these three mitzvos all target one objective. And the same applies to leprosy. When God is trying to break down a person's actions that are corrupt and he's slandering people, so he tries to send a message to that individual person. But he tries to do it in an easier way first, because God is merciful, and only then does he go to a more of a strict format. So at first he delivers the leprosy to the house, because that is something which a person identifies with. See, the concept of security, I can't have security in your house, I have security in my house. So part of the concept of being secure in something is that that something must be mine. I must identify with it. Only my clothing are going to help me have a better self-image, not your clothing. So in terms of when God is sending the leprosy as a punishment, he first sends it to your house, which is something you identify with, and somebody who doesn't live in your house won't heed that lesson properly, and rightfully so, because it's not his house. So if it's your house, you're the one that should be wondering, hey, what's going on? If you ignore the lesson, so then God sends it to the clothing, and now that's a little bit closer to you. It's not yet your body, but it is closer to you than your house. So now God's sending the message a little bit closer to you. If you still don't listen to the message and you still keep on speaking slanderously against your fellow, so eventually the leprosy will be sent to your body, which is undeniably you. No person could deny that their body is them. So we see that in both areas, the house and the clothing and the body are used because there are a common bond. The idea about identification by Tsuras, to know that it's you, that God is sending a message, so he sends it to objects that you identify with. But in terms of the area of breaking down security in objects, so then that again has to have the substratum, the underpinning that you identify with these areas, the house, your house, your clothing, and your body. So we see what the common bond is between the two. But it is an important lesson that what the mezuzah says should really be thought about, not just hung up on the door. Okay, any questions at this point?
No, that's great.
All right. Okay, so let's continue with Isaiah. So now we show that the nations will say, let us go to this place, and we'll go to the house of God, so meaning that Mount Moriah. Now, this is an interesting thing. We also didn't discuss this last week, but this whole concept of having a location, this mountain will be higher than the others, and higher than the valleys, and all the nations will stream to this mountain. What is so important about having a location? Right, it says in verses 2 and 3, 3 starts off by saying, and they will travel there, many people. Amim rabim, many people. And they will say, let us go, and let's go up to the mountain of God, to the house of the God of Jacob. And we will be taught, they will teach us of their ways, and we'll go in their paths. Evidently, at this time in the Messianic era, knowledge will have reached the far corners of the earth, of the knowledge of Judaism, a pure knowledge of it, an impressive knowledge of Judaism, to the point that, like it says in Deuteronomy, that other nations will look at the Torah and they'll look at the people, which is very significant. It says, what will the other nations say? Rak am chacham v'novan agoya gadol zeh. When they see all the statutes and they're impressed with the laws that we are keeping, the other nations will say that what a wise and understanding people this is. Their discussion, what are they describing? What is the object of their praise? The object of their praise is the Jewish people. And here it says that the other nations are going to stream to God's mountain. So what I'd like to understand is there something we can learn from both the fact that the nations are compelled to go to God's mountain, and also that when they see the statutes, their response is, what a wise and understanding people this is. Is there something we can derive from the reaction of the other nations, as well as here? And if you want to look at that verse, it's Deuteronomy 4:6. But now the question I'm opposing for everybody is, what is so significant that we have to be told that I guess we could say it that way, what is so significant about the mountain? And what is so significant that the other nations say that what a wise and understanding people this is? What can we derive from this? I think there's a lesson here. I mean, in both cases, there's a response from the other nations in connection with either God's mountain or the Jewish people. It's not an easy question, but there is something here, and that's why the Torah wrote down the response. The Torah is recording their response to give us a lesson. So, I think what we are being taught here is where the nations are at in terms of when they're first being initiated into the Torah lifestyle. The point in their development is that the impression is still coming from people, because that's one of the most powerful forces in man, is the social need. The proof is that the worst punishment in prison is solitary confinement. Why is it the worst punishment? Because that's something which a person needs the most. So you see that the psychological life of a person is even more important to them than their food. To make a person not eat for a few days, he'd rather have that than to be in solitary confinement. So what does it say over here? It says in Deuteronomy, when the Jew lives his life properly and upholds the Torah system with wisdom, so then the other nations will see these laws and understand the brilliance behind them. And they'll be able to ask a Jew on the street that's on the holiday of Sukkot, what are you waving these branches for? And the Jew will be able to respond that we're waving them in all the directions of earth to show that north or south or east or west, all of man's activities on earth, because all of man's activities are restricted to a horizontal plane, the horizontal surface of the earth. So we point this produce, that it's a bounty from God, that He is governing our actions. But he's governing our lives and giving us what we need, whether north or south or east or west. Anywhere we travel, anywhere we are on the surface of the earth, God is sustaining us. Not only that, but we wave our branches up and down also to show that not only on earth is God governing, but we wave the branches up to point to everything that's above the earth, the heavens, the cosmos, and then we wave them down to point to the earth, that everything in creation, whether it's the earth or everything above the earth, this is all created by God. Now, when a person who's not Jewish hears this, at first he looks at these Jews as they're crazy, they're waving these branches around. But then when he hears the explanation that I just quoted to you from the Talmud, the rabbi's explanation from the Talmud, I forget which rabbi it was, but then the person will hear it, whether it's a non-Orthodox Jew or whether it's a Gentile. They'll hear why we're waving it, and they'll see the idea behind forward and back, left and right. That's everything on the earth. That's man's domain. But then we wave it up and down because it's another concept. There's something outside of man's jurisdiction. There's also up in the sky, everything that was created. So when we explain this now, wow, that makes sense. And of course, you have to teach the person the concept of creation and God. But now it makes sense, and it appeals to his mind. So then he's impressed with it. But the starting point, I went off track for a minute, but the initiation into the system is always going to be where the person is impressed by the other person, I mean the social realm. So that's why it says in Deuteronomy that the other nations will say what a wise and understanding people this is. They're still attached to a social calendar, a social agenda. So that's why their praise is in terms of the other people. See, that's what really drives a person most of their life. It really is the goal of Torah, to get a person outside and to remove himself from being concerned with man, that really he should be more concerned with God. And what's the proof? Look at the last verse of our chapter here. The last verse, which is Isaiah 2:22, says, "Remove yourselves from man, that his soul is in his nostrils." Because what is he considered? He's nothing. Man is nothing. The very last words of this chapter are pointing to this idea that really you should try to remove yourself from the social sphere. Don't live your life based on whether my next-door neighbor thinks highly of me or doesn't. You have to live based on what is true. That's what we're supposed to be living, based on what's truth, what our mind tells us. That's what God wants. That's how He created us. That's why every single person has intelligence. Not that we should just be parrots and follow whatever the masses do because we want their approval. No, you see right there, this is God's words over here. Don't put don't invest your value into man. He's mortal. He lives and he dies. Really, your concern should be with the creator of the whole universe. He knows absolute knowledge. But nonetheless, we still have to recognize the truth that people do start their life when they're entering, they're initiating themselves into the Torah lifestyle. It does commence from being in the world of the social, the psychological realities, where people are really concerned with everybody else. And that has to be. That's every single person starts life that way, Jew, non-Jew. And this is something which, unfortunately, many people, I'm sure most people, have a hard time extricating themselves from this type of a life where they value what everybody else says. So what we're seeing here is that the praise of the Gentile, when they see the Jew living properly, it is in terms of the language that they're speaking at the time, which is the language of the psychological, where they're impressed with people. Eventually, it is the Jew's obligation to raise the person to the same level that he's on, to show him what really matters is God's approval, not man's approval. And again, those are the last words that we see here. And that's why also it says here that the nations want to go to the mountain. The significance of the place is because the location is where other people are. They want to now go to Jerusalem because this is where they'll see they'll learn from the Jews and they will teach us. So that's really the center of the Jewish culture. Okay. Let me just pause, see if there's any questions, any points.
Think we're good.
Okay. And if anybody online has any questions or comments, just type it into your screen at the bottom, right? And we'll be able to see it from here. Okay. Now, this is pretty much the basic idea that's running through this whole area. I mean, that's really what goes on. Now, if we carry this idea through, that the shortcomings of man is really in terms of his need for the social lifestyle, now we understand why it says the next verse, because it says in verse 3 that the nations will come and they want to hear the Torah. So the question we have is, why does verse 4 say that the Messiah will judge the other nations and rebuke them? I mean, if they're already coming to live a proper lifestyle and they're impressed with the Torah enough to travel all the way to Israel, to stream to Israel, so what now is there a need for the Messiah to also rebuke the other nations? And what does it say he's rebuking them in connection with? And he says that they will beat their plowshares into their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. And one nation will not lift its sword against another nation anymore, meaning war will cease, and they will not even learn about war anymore. Now, what is that lesson? I mean, the one thing is that the nations will know about they'll be impressed with the ideas of Judaism. So they will come streaming to Jerusalem to learn about them. Nonetheless, the Messiah is still going to have to rebuke them about certain issues. But the issues are going to be in the realm of war. Now, the question is what we asked last week. We said, if we have one nation, for example, you have this, Islamic Jihad. So they have their doctrines. They have their Islamic doctrines, and so if a nation of the Jews doesn't agree with them, so fine, let the Jews do what they want, or let whoever they're attacking do what they want, and the Muslims could practice what they want. But why is it that they have to have these holy wars? What is the cause of a holy war? They're not attacked. It's not a defensive war.
It seems like it would get back to that social need in man. He needs the approval or the acceptance or the validation of other people.
Right, exactly. He's not being threatened physically, but when he sees other nations that don't agree with his philosophy and they don't live that way, so then it bothers him severely, his own sense of security in his lifestyle is shaken, because how can it be that other nations are not following what I'm doing? It must be that it's awakening in them a threat. They understand unconsciously that there is something here which can be disagreed with. But if a person is convinced 100% in truth of what he's doing, so it doesn't matter that anybody does anything different. He actually is pity for the other people, because unfortunately they are not living properly, and I have the truth. If it's a scientist, if it's a person living by God's commands in the Torah, so that conviction is really what a person confides in, and what he realizes is true, and there's nothing that can threaten. When the mind knows that 2 plus 2 is 4, it doesn't matter what anybody else in the world does. He will not be shaken, he will not be bothered by it. If the rest of the world starts saying that 2 plus 2 is 5, a person who is a clear thinker and is emotionally stable and mature will not be bothered by the fact that the rest of the world says 2 plus 2 is 5. But the fact that those adherents to other religions that initiate these holy wars have to start these holy wars, it shows that they are shaken by what other nations are doing. That means that they have no confidence in their very religion. And that's why the Torah is saying over here, the Navi, the prophet, is saying that although the nations come and they learn the truth of ideas, there still is, that's one aspect. One half of the person is the intellectual. The other half of the person is the emotional. And that's something which still has to be addressed, and the Messiah will address that. That's verse 4. And he'll teach them about this whole concept of being secure in your ideas, and there will not be war any further, but he'll also remove war, not because he addresses their emotional makeup, but because he shows them how there's only one truth. And once there's only one truth, then there's no basis for war anymore. And that's why it talks all about war, and they will not learn war anymore. Meaning he will address that on many planes. He will, number one, he'll show essentially how their religions are false. That will remove all of the hatred, because you're going to hate somebody if they've got something different than you. But once everybody is following the same Torah, then that will be they will not learn war anymore. But it shows you that the Messiah has to train the other nations and the Jews as well, as we'll see in the next few verses. But he has to train the nations on correcting their moral and their morals and their ethics as well. So it's a two-pronged approach. Life is a two-pronged approach. That's why the Shema says that you're supposed to love your God with all your heart. What do you mean with all of your heart? You have one heart. So the rabbis say all of your heart means with both of your inclinations. Your inclination for the good, which is your intelligence, and your inclination for the bad, which is your base instincts. Okay. And let me just take Rob in Florida, who's making a comment. He says that Ishmael sees his service to God as a purification. Ishmael shall be at the throat of brothers. Okay, so Rob, you're quoting the Torah. So they're taking a verse in the Torah and, of course, distorting it and saying that since you will be a wild-ass nation, which is what the Torah says. So Ishmael is now trying to fulfill that statement of the Torah. But it doesn't mean he's supposed to be killing innocent people. Okay. All right, so now, so that's in terms of the other nations. But then it also starts addressing the Jew. The Jew also has to be addressed. And this is, again, the same need, the same social need is what caused the Jew to succumb. If you look at verse 6, that God forsook his people, the house of Jacob, because they were full of the idolatrous ways of the people of the East and the Philistines, and the ways of the youths, the philosophies they held on to, the alien youths. And in 7, it says that the earth, the land, the Jews' land was full of silver and of gold. They went after money to no end, it says. No end to their storage places. Vatimale Arzo Susam, and they filled the land with horses to no end, and also with chariots. So now you say that they were also involved in battle. Again, the social, the area of the social. Now, why is it, remember what we said last week, why is it that the Jews absorbed the philosophies of other people? What causes that? What causes one people to absorb the philosophy of another people?
Is it possibly the desire to feel an affinity towards them and feel like you're part of the group?
Right, and what promotes that? What causes a nation to want to be part of another group?
Well, it would seem that you don't have the conviction and the clarity about the ideas that you talked about earlier. If the ideas are clear to your mind, then theoretically that would control. But if you don't have that level of conviction and understanding...
You mean about your own ideas?
Right.
Right. And Adele... from Brazil is saying to be accepted. Right, Adele, exactly. A person wants that acceptance, that means there's an insecurity. What underlies the need for acceptance is the lack of security in your own way, and you need the social approval. Again, it goes back to the same concept, the need for the social. That social approval is what is, you know, killing both. It's causing the other nations to war with each other, to war with the Jews, and it's causing the Jews to try to get acceptance. So it's interesting, though. It's interesting. Why is it that the response is different? The other nation's response is to fight others, to try to wipe out people who disagree. And the Jews' response is to convert to another religion. It's interesting, there is a difference in terms of the response of each. See, the other nations, they know what they have is false, so they're shaken. But the Jew knows, the Jew should know when he sees an idea clearly, and he sees the Torah clearly, that there's nothing that's not true over here. So he's not trying, when he sees somebody else doing the opposite, he's not going to put them down because he feels a threat, because there is no threat. So it could be that that's why the Jew's response is different, because he's not operating from feeling threatened by another religion. But what he feels is just an emotion of wanting to have that acceptance, that social acceptance. So he'll start absorbing things in order to have it. But you see, there's a difference. It is an interesting thing. I got to think about that. But you see that the crime itself is spelled out in tests in the verse 9, where it says that man should lay himself low. He should go hide himself in a rock, into the ground, into the dust, because of the fear of God. So the reason why it says this now is because this is where the area is the need to be superior. The social, the need to be accepted, to have a elevated status in one's mind, is what the prophet is now addressing. And it says, no, you should really lower yourself. What you're doing is the opposite. The people here are trying to be haughty. They're trying to, in some way, both people are trying to raise themselves in their mind. And you see what extent people will live their life in order to spend so much energy just to have a sense in their mind that they are now superior. So it's not even a reality. It's just, as long as I can imagine myself better, I will work so hard for decades at a career, climb that corporate ladder. Whatever it is that a person's got in his mind, that becomes his reality, his ego ideal, as we call it. And he puts in so much effort, when really he could have had a much simpler life and spent more time in discovering what he's here for, to be involved in wisdom. And you see, when God says that a person should lay low, God will now be raised above all others in verse 12. And it starts talking about first the earth. God will be above the earth, all the valleys, the cedars of the Lebanon. all of the trees of the Bashan. In the end of 13 and 14, it says, on all the mountaintops, all the high mountains, and all the valleys, God will be lifted above, alone. Everyone will recognize God alone. That will be what has the focus. But then it moves on into 15, and all towers, all high towers. What's the difference between a high mountain and a high tower?
One was built by man, and the other was created by God.
Exactly. Being the Navi, the prophet here, is now teaching that God will also be raised above man's estimation. So not only will people focus on God as being the creator, but that very flaw that people have, that they are so impressed with man, they will now see God is above all these creations of man, the towers. You see, the theme follows through. All the towers and all the great sturdy walls and all the great ships of Tarshish and all the most splendorous palaces. These are four descriptions of what man makes. But he makes these things also for a reason, in order to have a feeling of self-aggrandizement. Tall towers, and you see that God destroyed the people. He scattered them. He didn't destroy them. The Tower of Babel. Because in Babel, what they were trying to do was create a name. V'naseh lanu shem. We will make for ourselves a name. They were trying to be involved in man's accomplishments and fight God. So God said, this is not a good thing. But what was the thing that they were building in order to make a statement about their great ingenuity and their architectural advancements and man's superiority and his technology? They built a tower. Look what we can build. This is a statement of man's invincibility, his greatness. And you see here as well, God mentions a tower. Because this is what God is trying to break down. Stop investing your energies into man and the need for approval, the need to be supreme over somebody else. You should lay yourselves low, it says now in 17. And God alone will be raised in that day. It repeats it. It says at the end of 11, and it says at the end of 17, it'll be God alone. And all of the idols, they'll be destroyed. And man will throw away his idols. Right? It says, where does it say that? Right. On 20. On that day, Yashlich Adam, man will cast away his idols of silver and gold that he made to bow down to them. Idols of animals, of bats. And again, he says the person should go, and he should go into the rock. He will be humbled because of the fear of God. And again, the verse that we mentioned, that man will be removed. You should remove yourself from man. Chidlu lechem min ha'adam. Stop putting so much energy into the human being that his soul is in his nose. I mean, it's temporary. It's not even permanent. Keep a man nechshavu, because what is he considered? What is man considered? So we see that the message is clear. That the need, that social need is something which promotes a lot of the downfall. It was the cause of war. It's the cause of the Jews to absorb alien philosophies. And this is primarily the message here that he's giving. Okay. All right, questions, comments?
Makes sense.
Well, it's interesting. It's right in the verses. You see, it's systematically. It's, I mean, again, it has to be because this is all divinely written. So there has to be a tremendous amount that we can glean from this area. All right. Let's see. Covered all the questions. mean, see also that the reason why the temple was constructed, according to a few of the great rabbis, was a concession to man's sin by the golden calf. Since man demonstrated that he could not live on the abstract plane and needed some sort of a physical expression when relating to God, so God made a concession and allowed them to have a temple, but the temple itself would work on directing their thoughts properly so they could have worship. But they would be in a very controlled atmosphere with many meticulous laws that have to be followed very carefully in order to restrain the emotions from having any type of a subjective expression, which is what the sin was with the golden calf. That was just a free expression of their own instincts. It's probably where the calf was made, because that was what they were used to in Egypt. So they created an animal, because animal worship is what they had in Egypt. So the temple was a response. So it was a location. It would have a way of approaching God. And Maimonides even says that animal worship was something that could not be commanded against. When the Jews had it in Egypt for so long, it would be impossible for God to tell the Jews to stop doing this action, and then they would just stop doing it. I think he equates it to the same impossibility would be if you try to tell a person not to pray to God when you have a need. A person can't just not pray to God. You need to have, you need to call out to the source that you know can accomplish, respond with your needs. So I said the Jews were so entrenched in this type of a lifestyle in Egypt for hundreds of years that it would be impossible to tell them to stop doing animal sacrifice. But what he did was he said, you can have sacrifice, but now what you're going to do is you're going to sacrifice the animals, but it'll be to me. So it'll redirect who the focus is of your worship. So he didn't make them change, to do a 180. That's impossible. You just can't change the personality, the psyche of a person overnight. So he let them have that type of an activity, but now constructed in the way that would be targeting God's objectives, that they raise themselves to an intellectual plane and understand monotheism and recognize that animals are really just animals, and that's it. Okay, let me just see on the screen. Somebody had a question here. Robbie in Florida is saying, how do we relate to this in modern times when man takes for granted so many abstract things? Atomic structure, right? Three styles of learning, visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. And, okay, so I guess, Rob, what you're asking is, how do you relate to this when we can be abstract? Well, that might be in areas of science, but man is dichotomized. And the same man who could be a great businessman will also read the horoscopes. What does that show you about him? All right, I'm directing this to you, Rob, in Florida, because you see that man can be very careful and systematic when it comes to one part of his mind. But when it comes to his insecurities, if he has not addressed that part, he can be just as archaic and backwards as a caveman. So modern times doesn't mean that man is modern. All right, don't confuse the two. Modern times just means that we have fancier toys. It doesn't mean that man is any more out of the woods in terms of elevating his psyche to be more in line with truth. You could have a person in the most beautiful suit and the most fantastic laptop in his hand and the greatest technology he produces every day, but that same person will feel that he's got to read his horoscope. So modern times does not mean that man has become more advanced, unfortunately. Okay, any questions or comments? Anything else?
I think for me, one of the interesting points here is I hadn't made that association with the worshiping of animals to then when the temple was constructed, the sacrifices, and that the animals were a reflection of the sacrifice.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maimonides has it. Do you have the book, The Guide for the Perplexed, Cal?
Yes, we do.
If you look in there, I'm not sure what chapter it is, but you see he talks about this. I was pretty much quoting from that chapter just now when I was talking about his explanation of the sacrifices. And Robbie, so you're saying that, as Robbie's pointing out, said the study of science should illuminate Torah. Yes, it should. There's a lot of things that should happen, but unfortunately people don't synthesize their lives. They can keep things very separate. Two compartments. So there's my business life. I can be very clear and analytic and rational. Comes to my religious life, I'll be very backwards and very idolatrous. Now, you see this many times. Many people like that. The Torah really tries to synthesize the two. And whatever we see, whatever we use in terms of the our knowledge, our thinking, in terms of analyzing the natural world, that is the same type of thinking that has to apply to the religious world. This is a battle which is, every single culture seems to be dealing with the same thing. They separate their ability to think rationally in science from using that very same, you know, reasonable approach to religion. When it comes to religion, they just shut the door on reason, and anything goes. That's, again, because of the crime of Judaism adopting these blind faith approaches. And it sounds so nice to the emotions, but we have to stop and think, is this right? Is this going to prove anything? If blind faith does not give us any knowledge, so this is not a correct path to go on. Okay, so looks like we'll wrap it up at this point. So we finished up, so we'll continue on Sunday. Next Sunday, we'll go back to the regular time, 11:15 New York time, and we'll pick up Chapter 3.
Okay.
All right, so we'll look it up.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. We appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. It's a really interesting chapter, this one, huh?
Yeah.
I did not expect to see all this. So we're lucky.
You know, when you talk about the messianic times, it makes me think that you see so many people who have such a powerful religious emotion that even when you see the logic behind an idea, they will not let go of that religious emotion. And how is that going to come about to have people see the truth?
Yeah, that's a good question. How do you change a person who's so attached to emotion? I think it's just a matter of time. They have to constantly keep on hearing, or maybe work from their own framework, because any person who's living into adulthood has to be doing something in their life that's according to reason. They're not going against how to make money. They're not going against how to eat food. They're not going against maintaining the health of their body. And they're not in prison, so they must be following certain reasonable laws that are keeping them, in a safe haven in society, and healthy and alive, and somewhat successful financially. Now you show them that the reason why they're in that condition is because they're using reason in all those areas, and they will admit it. And then hopefully you can help them transfer it over to the religious sphere. So that's actually what the concept is behind the parable. The concept that that King Solomon uses, the whole book of Proverbs, is that he's trying to teach ideas, but he draws on the reservoir of information that we already have and teaches a lesson. He says, for example, how does he teach a lazy person that he can really accomplish in life? Because a lot of times a person is lazy because he just feels inadequate and he just can't move himself. So he says, look at the ant. Look how it can gather, and it's a small, tiny thing, and yet it takes care of all of its needs. And they work, you have teamwork between the ants, and so on and so forth. So he's trying to get the person to look at things that he knows already, that his mind already admits as being a reality. Now, once your mind can wrap itself around that truth, and you accept and you embrace, and you're convinced that this is something that an ant can do because you can look at it and see it, so now look at yourself. You're 10,000 times bigger than an ant. That should give a person some encouragement. So he works from an area of that you're familiar with to extrapolate to new areas that you maybe have not been able to approach yet because it's too distant from that person. I mean, the concept of a parable, I mean, like a person says, if a person wants to express how hungry he is to say, I'm so hungry I can eat a horse. So he's using an example for a child's mind. He knows a horse is very big and you can't fit it, but he wants to express the concept of hunger, which maybe the child didn't really experience yet because it's been fed its whole youth. So a person will properly draw on the experiences of the child. The child knows what's very big, and now taking the concept of big from an animal, he could now teach the child about a big appetite. So that's the same way, we perhaps, to answer your question, Cal, how we can approach somebody who's just not there yet. Use whatever they try to look into their own repertoire and see what their experiences are that you can tap into, and use that as a an analogy to other areas.
No, that's very interesting, because a bunch of moms and kids, all of us went to see that new movie called Freedom Riders.
Right.
And she uses that, the teacher, she's a brand new teacher, has never really taught before. And the system tells her basically to be a babysitter to these integrated students who are Hispanic and white and black and Asian. And they're all fighting in gangs and everything. And she takes that common element of the gangs and this fighting, and she uses the whole Holocaust. She says, I'll show you somebody who was very, very powerful and, the biggest gang ever. And she used their language and everything, and then ends up taking them to the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Right, so she did the same thing. She spoke the language.
Right, spoke their language, and that was how she was able to influence change.
Hmm. Very good. Yes, that's probably how to do it here. It probably takes time, too, because there's a lot of resistances. You have to be aware of people's resistances when you're speaking to them. And sometimes it's not the idea that they disagree with. It's just that, like you said earlier, that they just cherish something so much, or they're used to it so much. So you have to be clever in terms of understanding. Try to clarify what you think, and how you have to assess where is the resistance coming from. All right. All right, so we'll look over chapter 3, and we'll pick up 11:15 on a week from today, then.
Okay.
Sounds good. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Okay, and feel free to communicate during the week if there's any questions that come up or any comments that, maybe we left open ends on anything in the class, all right?
Okay, will do.
Okay.
Take care and have a great week.
You too. Take care, Doug. Take care. Okay, so that wraps up today's session. If you missed any part of it, we will post it online shortly, so you'll be able to hear the entire session. It'll be posted underneath the audio link on the Masora website. Hope you enjoyed it, and we will continue next week at 11:15 a.m. That's New York time, 11:15 a.m. New York time. We'll pick up Isaiah chapter 3. All right, a good week to everybody.